welcome listeners to Connect the Dots. I'm Allison Rosini, and we're here with you every Wednesday at 10 a.m. Eastern Time on the Progressive Radio Network. Each week on Connect the Dots, we connect the dots between your well-being and the well-being of your community, our society, and all of the interconnected species and living forms here on planet Earth. And each week on the show, we talk with different thought leaders, experts, journalists, advocates, authors, and a whole host of other people about everything going on in our interconnected world. I'm a longstanding journalist of the environment, public policy, health, food, agriculture, and the media. And we also discuss a fair amount of politics, because this is a time where we need to promote engagement, organizing, advocacy, activism, and awareness in order to really be able to survive long-term as a species, because both democracy and our environment are currently under threat. The show has been going on the air. We're now in our ninth year, and we discuss a whole range of topics. And if you like and enjoy this show, you can find a lot more in our current archives. Today, I am happy to have as a guest a wonderful young journalist whose work I've been following and admiring for a while. And I hope I'm not butchering your name here, but he is Bronco Marsetic, who writes for Jacobin Magazine and other publications. And I'm so pleased to have him with us today and we'll be discussing some of his recent articles as well as his insights and outlook. So welcome to Connect the Dots, Bronco.
Thanks very much for having me, and good work in pronouncing the name. I'd say 90% score.
Okay. So did I get your name pronounced correctly? Can you pronounce it for me?
Yeah, the last name is Marčetić.
Marčetić, okay.
Yeah, so it's a Serbian name, so originally those C's would have little symbols that denote that you pronounce it with a ch sound. But, when you go into an English-speaking context, those symbols are meaningless to people and they kind of disappear. So, it's a little confusing.
No, I get it. Marčetić, that makes complete sense. Bronco Marčetić, thank you. What I'd like to begin talking about is this is a subject that has been written on, but I think your take on it is really clarifying, and it's really, really important. And that is, the perils of bipartisanship. We're coming out of an epoch, and I think we can see this reflected in some, but not all, of the candidates for the Democratic nomination for president. Where bipartisanship, we have to compromise, we have to all hold hands, everyone gets a say, we have to work with all people, has been a kind of de rigueur, MO, modus operandi or myth of what's going on in the recent, 30-year, neoliberal epoch, that has kind of put us into this parallel decline. And I think it's so ingrained in people's minds that in a sense we can't talk about it enough. And in your recent article, in these times, I just thought it was like an absolutely brilliant, analysis of what it is and what the fallacy of it is. So if you could kind of open up that perspective a bit for our listeners, I think it's, I'd love to hear it, and I know many people in our audience would too.
Well, first of all, it's very kind of you to say all those very nice words about the piece. I mean, the basic point of it is, I think in some ways the political conversation has changed in the U.S. It has moved away from this idea of bipartisanship, which really was this kind of all-consuming idea. Even if, it was just sort of something that people paid lip service to, it really was this thing. If you read the debates back in 2008, so many candidates, Joe Biden, Hillary Clinton, New Mexico governor, or then New Mexico governor, Bill Richardson, they all, paid tribute to bipartisanship. Obama did, of course. And that was also one of the things that really kind of sunk Obama's presidency, among other factors. was that he seemed to have a genuine faith in this idea of reaching across the aisle and you know, always leaving an outraged hand for the other side to take, which they again and again batted away or used to undermine what he actually wanted to do. And so my piece basically argues, because you still hear the David Brooks, for example, and of course Joe Biden being kind of really the only one left, who's still saying, no, the Republicans, they're going to come around, you know, they're going to completely change once Trump's out of office. But you still hear this stuff, and you hear journalists talking about the need to come together and meet in the middle. And one of the things that gets left out of this whole story is that the fact is the reason that they can't meet in the middle is because the GOP, I mean, both parties have changed, but the GOP more than the Democrats, far more has become this ideologically homogenous and very radical force. And, you know, that's not just me saying it. I mean, famously, you know, political scholars Thomas Mann and Norman Ornstein. Norman Ornstein's someone at the American Enterprise Institute. Not a progressive think tank by any means, but a conservative one. They said back in 2002 that the GOP was this, quote, insurgent outlier, that it was ideologically extreme, that it was contemptuous of science and compromise and basic facts. And that's, the story of how the GOP got that way, that's a very long and complex tale, but part of it's to do with the influence of money in U.S. politics. Part of it is also to do with the fact that the party was really in a very kind of mirror image to what's happening with the Democrats now. It was sort of taken over by this this radical force. But the end result of that is that there's no case for bipartisanship, because on all the big issues that confront Americans, well, you know, climate change probably above all, but also, you know, anything that the Democratic contenders talk about now, Medicare for all, breaking up the big banks, what have you, there is no possibility of compromise with the GOP, because we've seen that they will, their sort of approach to being out of government is to basically just try and obstruct and government works as much as possible to stop anything from happening, so they can then, you know, come back to power in a wave election. So that's sort of, I don't know if people really should read the whole piece, but that kind of gives you a broad overview of what I'm kind of arguing in it.
Yeah, the thing that it's interesting, because in the recent CNN town hall on climate and the environment, which I attended the taping of and, you know, was watching closely, we did have several candidates, Joe Biden being the most prominent, Pete Buttigieg, also saying, oh, we have to heal the divide and bring people together in the middle. And, obviously, theoretically, that would have some appeal if you were reading, like, a storybook or a fairy tale of, you know, what would be the happy outcome, without having looked at the history of what has transpired. The thing that happens also, I think, and maybe you could address this, is, you know, on the one hand, we know, on some level, we know that the Republicans are just, you know, have been increasingly over time more and more and more kind of baring their teeth and revealing their radicalism and their intransigence and their lack of cooperation. But what we don't seem to know as well, or, you know, some people don't know, but others have figured it out, is the fact that it's the Democratic Party response to this that has also created a totality of decreasing leverage to intervene. So, you know, if one party is kind of an outlaw, a gangster, you know, and the other party is, you know, just trying to placate and reason with them, in some way, you know, it's a failed strategy. Can you, you know, kind of explore that a little bit and, you know, like what have the, you know, liberal, neoliberal side, you know, failing to get is doing wrong? You know, why, you know, how has this not worked and what do they need to be shifting to, you know, and what some people are shifting to that would be, you know, that would really be better? And then maybe after, you know, you've described that, we can talk about, like, why people are so stuck. Some people are so stuck on, you know, kind of regressing into that placating approach.
Yeah, well, you know, I think for a lot of, for a guy like, say, Bill Clinton, right, from his point of view, he wanted to get something done. And what that was didn't really matter so much as just sort of having something that you can point to. Look, I've been, you know, look at what my accomplishments are. So, the Clinton, and this is especially when they brought in Dick Morris. Clinton, mm-hmm. I think, was quite happy to, especially because Clinton, I think, also was a true believer in the third way, you know, the neoliberal third way, the idea of basically the system that we have now, which is basically politics, except for the maybe a patina of liberalism and so on. And so for him, it was very easy. You know, he, in his at the end of his first term and his second term, tried very hard to compromise the GOP. And basically, because they control Congress, he just went along with their agenda, which was welfare reform. It meant immigration reform. I mean, that's actually one thing that people, I think, don't realize nowadays is that the deportation state that people complain about now, that Obama really ramped up and that Trump is kind of taken to new steam levels. That deportation state was really created under Clinton, you know, as one of these third-way measures, as a way to sort of co-opt the agenda of the right in order to neutralize. Now, and that was the idea. And, of course, for people like Clinton and Dick Morris, the idea was that this way the Republicans would electorally collapse because their agenda would have been taken by Democrats and so voters would flock to Democrats. And while that might be somewhat true, what it misses out is the larger picture, which is that the Republicans really win. Because what you're doing, yes, they're losing seats maybe, but their agenda is still getting through. And that's really, you know, that was really the maybe, well, let's not say the greatest, but it was definitely one of the greatest accomplishments of Ronald Reagan, which is that he helped to not just, you know, transform the Republican Party into what it is now, but he helped transform his opposition in his own image, to reshape the Democratic Party in his own image. And, you know, I mean, it starts in the 80s and it really has ramped up since then. And now we're at this point where, you know, the Democrats were voted in with this in 2018 was this huge mandate to resist Trump. And, you know, the Democratic Party leadership doesn't really seem like it's interested in resisting Trump at all, really. But that's sort of the basic story, is that by constantly reverting to the compromise, and middle ground as a political strategy, all it's done is just lead to right-wing victory after right-wing victory after right-wing victory. And then you see this other couple of lawmakers now who are coming up, Sandra Ocasio-Cortez, Ilhan Omar, Shia Tlaib, Ayanna Presley, Squad, as they're being referred to. They're taking an approach that's far more reminiscent of the GOP and the Gingrich, which is these insurgents who are sort of fed up with the timidity of the old order, and want to and don't just want to instinctively compromise, but actually want to make their forces reality. Whether that ends up becoming a bigger part of the Democratic Party is, you know, obviously we're going to have to see. But I think that is it's a more viable option for you know, pushing things in a more progressive direction than just trying to call the right-wing agenda for yourself. Hello?
Sorry. Have you looked into why is this, why does this strategy have appeal for people, for some people? I mean, I think a lot of people are, what a relief, how refreshing. At last we have voices of people who are wanting to break through and intervene in these terrible, terrible, this terrible devolution. And yet, the fact that Joseph Biden has any popularity at all, even if there are any people at all who think he's a good idea other than, Democratic Party insiders who are knowing that, there'll be a lot of people who, contribute to his campaign, a lot of Wall Streeters, a lot of industries. They can run it, in a well-funded campaign, so the party is in favor. But, there's also apparently a somewhat sizable, although now the polls show that's reducing, segment of the population that also, still believes that this is possible. And every time, he hasn't taken his sort of position and redirected it at all. Every time you hear him speak, it's about, I know how to sit down at the table and, I've dealt with these people before. And, and this is, some people find that, believable and this old failed strategy, a good thing to replicate right now. Why is that? Who does that appeal to? What is, what do you see as the reason for, maintaining this unsuccessful, retrogressive, losing strategy?
I think it's important to remember that people like Biden and a lot of this, a similar generation of Democrats, they all came up in this period of defeat for not just the left, but liberalism in general. In the 70s, you have recession, stagflation, Jimmy Carter's administration can't seem to get it under control. You have things like the taxpayer revolt of 1978, where obviously California is still dealing with it, but they passed a proposition that it's very difficult to pass tax raises. And that sort of catches fire across the country. You have this massive middle class taxes. Then in the 80s, Reagan comes in, he wins on this, what was at the time, a very radical government platform. He wins re-election, and he doesn't just win re-election, but he really gives a Democrat a drubbing on the presidential level. And for people like Biden, the lesson that they took away from all these challenges to liberalism and defeat that period was that the period of a New Deal is over, and now we have to, we have to talk about balancing the budget. We have to talk about cutting the deficit. We have to take on some of the characteristics of the right in order to survive. It's similar to what happened in the post-New Deal era after Roosevelt was in office, where similar to Reagan, Roosevelt really changed his opposition. So even conservatives, conservative politicians, they realized that they couldn't fight this this New Deal tidal wave, that they had to go along with. Famously, Dwight Eisenhower. There were the radical right in the 50s was pushing for the Republican Party, similar to how a lot of the left progressives right now are annoyed at the Democratic Party for being too extreme with the GOP. At the time of the 50s, the radical right was calling for, we have to get rid of Social Security, we have to get rid of all these government services. And Eisenhower said, that that's ridiculous because anyone who would eliminate these programs would never be reelected. And so it's that same mindset that has been transplanted onto the Democrats of Joe Biden's generation, who are just constantly in defeat, who constantly how, like, an losing battle. And, you know, I mean, people said this about Bill Clinton. They said this is how they justified everything he did, every terrible thing he did, where he basically tried to eviscerate the New Deal. They said, well, Clinton is actually, he's continuing FDR's work because he's saving liberalism. The only way to save it is by basically helping to destroy it. That was at least the justification that they gave. And yeah, for a guy like Biden, I think he still doesn't see that things are changing. And more to the point, I mean, you know, I think the Bernie Sanders comparison, I think it's interesting here, because at the same time that Biden's response to Reagan coming to power was to sort of try and co-opt his agenda and make it the agenda of the Democratic Party. You have Bernie Sanders, he gets elected at the height of the Reagan Revolution in Burlington as mayor, and he launches a sort of class-based attempt to reshape the city. He also takes up the anti-tax bank, but instead of calling for lower taxes on the rich, he says, let's reduce property taxes, but increase taxes on the rich, increase taxes on the rich, and get our revenue that way. And, you know, Sanders, over 8 years, succeeded in the transition to Burlington, and really kind of this political revolution that he talks about kind of, you know, really did happen in Burlington. And that was a different style of politics. It was a class-based style of politics that put an economically populist agenda at the forefront to sort of get as much public support as possible. But the thing is, the people that have heard the Democratic Party for the past, if ever, they haven't had that style of politics. They don't have that vision. They're neoliberals. They want to win over the, as they call it, the professional managerial class, and they also win over, you know, these op-ed writers for whom fiscal austerity is sort of this religion. And I also, at the same time, you know, you can't forget the influence of money. So all these people that are getting money and donations from wealthy donors, I mean, those wealthy donors tend to be more economically conservative than the average voter. And so when they are just giving, you know, loads and loads of cash to these politicians, and the only way that they can win is to sort of try and at least meet the spending that their opponent has, they're probably going to end up sort of moving into a more conservative direction. So it's a lot of things, I think.
Mm-hmm. Well, of course, the backdrop of this is that, you know, is the money in politics, the money, you know, the corporate underwriting of the media, and the corporate control of the media. You know, those are the kind of larger structural forces. Let's talk a little bit more about the media, because I'm constantly amazed. You know, there's a certain nexus of people that are following independent media and, you know, and giving it credibility. And there are many other people who don't even know that it exists, you know, and that there's anything other than mainstream media. And one of the things that occurred at the CNN climate town hall that I thought was kind of amazing, really, was that, for reasons unknown, CNN, who, you know, certainly could have continued a policy of softball questions to the, you know, putative present or now declining front runner for the nomination, Biden, chose instead to allow him to be confronted, you know, by an active story, by somebody who was representing an active story from The Intercept. And this is a young, academic who confronted Biden about the fact that, you know, the purpose of the town hall was to discuss climate. Yet he was planned to go directly from this discussion into a fundraiser hosted by a gas and oil industry executive. And, you know, it led to a situation where Anderson Cooper was, I was at the taping, he was being handed notes, and he was quoting from The Intercept, and it was kind of actually the raising of this question, which they allowed to be raised because all the questions were streamed, meant that, you know, the producing staff was, you know, backstage somewhere researching, by the denial that this guy, you know, no longer was in an active role or that he was unaware that this guy had even been affiliated with the fossil fuel industry, even though it was well established that he was an executive and founder of an LNG, you know, liquefied natural gas major corporation. And in fact, this same gentleman had fundraised for Biden before in his previous presidential bid and is a longtime ally. So how would he not know that and need to, you know, rely on FCC findings? And all of this, in effect, was outed by The Intercept and then quoted and given currency on CNN. And so that in and of itself was such a rare turn and such a rare occurrence. And it was almost like a moment when independent media, which is always breaking stories and always in advance of, you know, of a lot of what is covered by corporate news, you know, gained a moment of ascendancy. But in general, you know, I'm sure many people listening to that broadcast had never heard of The Intercept. And many people, you know, don't even know that a different kind of media exists.
I mean, you know, the key question is, who asked that question, right? It was an audience member, right?
Yes.
It wasn't a CNN anchor. Then, you know, I've actually talked to quite a few people today from environmental groups about what they thought about the. And you know, they've said that, you know, they thought that the worst questions came from the actual professional journalists. The best questions were, you know, from the actual audience members. And, you know, I have to say, what I've seen of the sample last night, I agree. So yeah, I mean, it's we're going to a point where we're just ordinary people without all this sort of fancy degrees and titles and everything that the, you know, reporters and media have. I'm actually doing a better job of, you know, being journalists than the actual professional journalist.
Well, yeah, that's pretty ironic. I mean, in effect, some people have stepped up and other people don't know that it's going on. Where do you think we are on this? The other thing is that it's very difficult for independent outlets to have the kind of viability, that the mainstream advertising for profit-based ones do. Do you see the audience expanding in this current time? Do you think more and more people are really kind of stepping up and seeing that? Is it mainly a younger generational thing? Or, you know, like, how are we doing in that regard?
I think it's still a bit of an uphill battle for independent media. I think, you know, I totally understand and agree with all the critiques of social media and Facebook and Twitter. I think it is going to be really unhealthy for the common of the but I think also they and the internet more generally really has helped to democratize the flow of content for all the flaws of the internet. I mean, just that fact, I think, that The Intercept report was able to make it onto system wide stage. But, you know, I've seen, even with things I've written, and I've written only for small independent magazines, but every now and then you write something and it can really get into the hands of someone who is more established, as a more common platform, who then promotes it. And I think you're seeing that more and more. And I think the other thing is, as well, I mean, the American public's trust in media, and I would say this is not even just the American public, I think this is the public trust in media has really massively declined. Some of that isn't the media's fault, of course. But, a lot of it is. I hate to say it, but, you know, the coverage of the Iraq War, between the Russiagate stuff that we just we went through, what, 2.5 years of just nonstop conspiracizing from the most sort of establishment, quote unquote, serious sources, and then it was all completely just proven wrong, and then there hasn't been evidence again, sort of just disappeared off the face of the earth. All that stuff, I think, has really dented the media's credibility. Also, look at the recent incident between the Washington Post and the Bernie Sanders campaign, where the Washington Post fact checkers claimed that, you know, the 500,000 medical benefits a year claim that Sanders has in a speech is false, which is, you know, and it wasn't at all. But I guess because they have such a the fact checkers there have such a visceral dislike for Sanders, they busted themselves up in a pretzel to try and somehow pass this off as a false claim, and you know, to an embarrassing way, you know, that became a huge story in multiple outlets. So I think all that stuff has really hurt the credibility of the kind of mainstream media, and I think that, and the fact that it's increasingly easy to be able to access more independent outlets like in these times, the Chicago magazine, for which I wrote the Joe Biden piece, or, for example, Jacobin magazine, which is the magazine that I work for alongside that, I think has made it easier for these outlets to kind of have a voice. Now, the only question is, you know, how do we fund independent media, you know, in an age where everything's free? Sure. That, I think, is the biggest.
Yeah. I mean, and of course, this is in a larger context where, you know, the media is bought and then the candidates, you know, are accepting corporate money. And, you know, we have a whole, we've kind of normalized that. And it's kind of like, you know, somehow that the Kochs and the people who support the right wing are the bad players. And yet, you know, you can have, here we are trying to, you know, solve a climate problem and giving lip service. And, you know, we have people who go all the way from, I'm being funded by a fossil fuel executive to people who are maybe reluctant to do things like ban fracking and think we can get there by regulatory measures, you know, to people who, like Bernie Sanders, are outright, wanting to ban and have long time proposed banning fracking and, you know, really a complete shift from this destructive form of energy. So, you know, in the shadows of these candidates are, you know, and on the Republican side, of course, the Kochs, you know, are pipeline and energy, you know, that's a huge part of their empire. So, and as well as their funding and fueling and delaying our ability to do anything through climate denial. So we have a spectrum, but, you know, what we don't usually have, with the exception, of course, of Bernie Sanders, is somebody who really wants to pull the plug on the whole thing. You know, I also really appreciated the piece that you did on the passing of David Koch, one of the Koch brothers. Some see him as, you know, the less cruel and toxic of the Koch brothers. But I really appreciated that piece because, you know, it was like a no-holds-barred description, you know, of what he was about. And, you know, rather than being kindly, you know, as a human being, you know, we're all human and he is past and, you know, that's a sad thing. You were like, no, no, let's, you know, really portray what this man and his brother have done to us. So, you know,
you know, whenever anyone dies, anyone public dies, there's always this kind of, we can't say it's bad about it. Of course, this is standard that it's bizarrely applied and consistently applied. I mean, I doubt people would say the same thing about, you know, Donald Trump's side, for example. I'm sure there are a lot of people who hate Donald Trump and thoroughly object to the obituary, the sort of, you know, whitewashed, the worst. you know, when I wrote about this, I did get feedback from people, including my mom, who kind of was like, well, you know, yeah, what you're saying is true, but oh, did you have to sort of be that harsh? And my answer is, yeah, I think I did, because I wrote about David Koch the same way that you would write about someone like Hitler or and some other great historical monster, Joseph Stalin, Pol Pot, what have you. People who, you know, no one in this day and age would say, oh, I think that history of Hitler was a little harsh. Why didn't they talk about the fact that he liked dogs? That seems like a nice thing. No, that's an absurd thing. I mean, with David Koch, I mean, if David Koch's life's work actually comes to fruition, and his life's work, make no mistake, was attempting to secure the extinction of life on Earth at all costs. I mean, at the very end of his life, he and his brother were fighting public transit and are still fighting public transit projects at the local level because it would eat into their own profit. And so, you know, climate change be damned, any solution to a climate crisis, but all of it, that doesn't matter as much as and, you know, I mean, I think I sort of paraphrase Chomsky in that piece. And he used that phrase to so the Republicans who are just sort of escalate climate, not even trying to prevent it or even doing nothing, but actually willfully making climate change intensify. And, you know, he said that you know, the word evil doesn't really even begin to describe this, and I would, I wholeheartedly steal that point and that phrase, and I think the word evil really doesn't even begin to describe what David Koch and his brother are doing. But, I mean, and the few good things that they did, you know, funding the criminal justice reform and cancer research, which, by the way, I mean, David Koch was I mean, let's not go too far into describing that as a completely altruistic sort of, you know, his cancer funding. But I mean, all that stuff, yes, it's all well and good, but none of it will matter if the climate crisis, which David Koch fought to his dying breath to advance and to fight against any attempt to stop it, if the climate crisis ratchets up in the way that scientists fear, all these good things that the Kochs did, all these, you know, the funding of the museums and everything they did, it will not matter a little bit. And I don't feel the need to, and I think people shouldn't feel the need to whitewash that out of some sort of misplaced sense of propriety, I guess.
I agree with you. You know, I mean, these people really should be, you know, brought to international trial in the way that the, you know, the Nuremberg trials followed, you know, the Holocaust and World War II. I mean, they really, the idea that people, you know, should pay, that their behavior should be, you know, clearly named, that it shouldn't be normalized, that we shouldn't forgive it. I mean, and this all goes back to, you know, the original topic we were talking about at the beginning of the show, which is, you know, the sense that, oh, well, this is the way things have to be done, and, you know, we must compromise with that, and there's no other way to do it, possibly because we ourselves would find it too disruptive to do a change. And so, you know, people's understanding of even what is possible shrinks to kind of fit a very corrupted situation. And in fact, it represents a corruption of our own minds, of our own understanding, of our own values that we are actually have been led over time to condone and enable all of this. And so I think there are people who, you know, are kind of strongly on, and more young people have a kind of fresh perspective to kind of, you know, wake up and say, well, this, you know, this is wrong. A, it's not going to work for us. We're not going to be surviving and thriving through this. Whereas, you know, people who are older kind of have to look at the fact that they've condoned it all along. And I think there has to be a way of, you know, really looking at that. And one of the ways to begin is to really look at the people who are actively doing this now.
Let me just add one thing before we move on. I think it's also important to talk about this kind of thing, especially with climate. It's not just a policy disagreement. Where, oh, this person had different policies. And David Koch, and he's not alone. There are many like him. I mean, they have financed. They have fought against climate change, which again is a matter of survival for the rest. And again, you know, if some of the predictions end up happening, which they will if we just sit by and do nothing, we're talking about suffering and death on a scale that we have not seen in our lifetimes, and perhaps have never been seen in human history. So that's the stakes that we're talking about. And I think if we just sort of refer to it as just like, oh, it's just politics. It doesn't really speak to who this person was, or you know, it doesn't really speak to the nature of the faction. I think that's very wrong. I think we have to look at it in those stocks.
Yes. Yeah. No. I think that's really, because you know, we're talking about an epochal extinction process that is very far advanced at this point. You know, this is just a kind of side note, but one of the things that has kind of entered the language that I have kind of mixed feelings about is describing the climate crisis as an existential crisis. You know, to tell you the truth, to me, that's an obfuscating word. It's a long word. It's a distancing word. And, you know, when everyone is talking about that as if we all know what that means, and I actually think it's poor languaging and framing, and we don't really know what that means. And what does it mean that it's existential? I think that's just a long-winded word to say it's a big deal in some kind of way. It's not the same as saying climate crisis will kill me. You know, if you're talking about the eradication systemically of existence, all living existence, all life, you know, or most life on planet Earth, to me, that is clearer than using this fancy word, which everyone keeps using. I'm just throwing that out there because I think it matters the way we talk about things, and I think that's like quite distancing.
Yeah, you know, I think part of that is there's a worry that sort of putting things into, basically describing things as they actually are, and how kind of alarming everything is. I think, there's a fear that will sort of turn people off. It'll make them more apathetic, right? So, and I think there have actually been studies that show this. So I suspect that's sort of where that comes from. It's a word that, as you say, is distancing, but still sort of has, or conveys a sort of alarm or threat, and so you can use it to kind of get across the scale of the issue we're looking at, but not to scare people into just sort of hiding under the cupboards and never doing anything. That's sort of my interpretation anyway. I can't suggest.
Yeah, well, you know, that makes sense too. I mean, the problem is it's just always on every level so much bigger, you know, than we are. And it's terrifying. And, you know, any way you frame it, it is disturbing and terrifying because it's so outside. Let's just shift gears here for, you know, the last 10 minutes or so of the show. What are you working on now? Like, what do you have upcoming?
I'm doing a piece on very early stages of doing a piece on the candidate climate plans. We'll see how that shapes up in the days to come. Besides, I actually am working on a book about Joe Biden and his whole career, because I've already spent probably way too much of my life delving into his record and life's work, and so I'm doing a book that will be published under the Jackman imprint. That's sort of a history of Joe Biden's career in the Senate and as vice president, which we think, I mean, there's a lot of stuff that's already been written about his history, but I think there'll be a lot of stuff in this book once it's eventually out, and presuming that Joe Biden doesn't have a stroke or something in the next couple of months, there'll be some stuff in there that'll be, I think, interesting to people, particularly around his earlier career, that people don't really have as much knowledge about. That's sort of the big major thing. Otherwise, you know, in these times, I'm tasked with writing about the entire 2020 campaign, so I have a few, I'll have sort of stories coming out in these times throughout the rest of the campaign, which, you know, they should, and they like the Joe Biden piece, they should look up for them.
No, that'll be great. Listeners, please do look out for Bronco March It Kicks. I got it correctly this time. Pieces coming up in Jacobin and in these times. I'll very much look forward to reading them. I don't want to kind of breach onto your upcoming territory too much, but, you know, it was good in the Climate Town Hall that recently happened that we've been alluding to, you know, that the field of candidates is being thin. You know, we don't have, like, so many candidates that, you know, everybody gets 20 seconds and they have to fight for it. I think the town hall format had really a lot to offer in terms of allowing members of the public, even though the questions were screened, to get at some deeper issues. At the same time, you know, it's kind of really become fairly clear that there are three front runners, and depending on the polling, you know, they're kind of, you know, you can't say there's one per se, you know, completely for sure, but there are three of them that are kind of lingering at the top, and then there are, you know, a bunch of people with pretty low numbers, some of them even well-funded by Wall Street or whomever. Do you have any thoughts either about the three in the lead or about, you know, the kind of bottom picks in the pile that you'd like to share with our listeners today?
I don't want to predict anything because I think everyone learned pretty well in the last election and just every election around the world that predicting elections is a fool's game. But yeah, certainly at this point, it does seem like there's going to be this kind of triumvirate of candidates that's going to go into the bottom and kind of fall behind. Obviously, interestingly, you know, Harris fell behind, and I think a lot of people are kind of saying, oh, well, she needs to turn right now. She needs to, like, you know, play out that she's actually kind of a centrist. But, you know, that to me is actually what made her kind of think in the polls is that once she came up with that really bad Medicare for all, but, you know, that's what she called it. She came up with that terrible healthcare plan that was absolutely nonsensical. I mean, 10 years to implement it, that's a joke. And then also, obviously, her record as a prosecutor had a light shone at by Tulsi Gabbard. I do think it's interesting that she has, her polling has fallen as she's been revealed to be less progressive than she claimed. I think it's a good sign for anyone who happens to be of that political persuasion and wants to see those values in the next presidency. But yeah, I mean, beyond this, what's going to happen? I have no idea. I mean, I've sort of gone back and forth on whether Biden's going to end up going to the very end, or if he's, part of me thinks he's just going to drop out in the next couple of months, or just, you know, really tank in the polls. It's honestly very difficult to say. I mean, and if that happens, what would really be interesting is then you would potentially have a fight between Warren and Sanders, who, you know, everyone, the media likes to say are exactly the same. Of course, they're not. They're much more similar than either is to the rest of the field. But of course, there are very, very important differences between the two on issues like foreign policy and you know, well, healthcare and the environment. So that would be interesting. I mean, if that ends up being the sort of contest, I think there's going to be an interesting debate happening there, because until now they have sort of been presented as identical, and then you have, you know, can start to draw the contrast between each other themselves, which would probably be a healthy debate, I think. But yeah, I know that those are my sort of stray thoughts. I want to again stress the caveat: I have no idea what's going to happen. Somebody could even, you know, for all we know, someone could die. Which should completely upend the field. So that's all I can say about that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's interesting because, you know, my recent contemplation about Warren is I think she's like a terrific popularizer and presenter that has appeal, and that also as a female candidate, you know, it's really nice to hear a woman making some of these criticisms. At the same time, some of the criticisms really have been handled in depth and originated by Bernie Sanders. So, you know, and carried by him for decades and fought for by him for decades. And so there's a little bit, I mean, I perceive the differences. I mean, one can get down to the policy distinctions, which I think, as you point out, will happen in the upcoming debate. And continually, no doubt. But you know, the other difference is a more pleasing delivery, you know, possible to certain swaths of the public that covers, you know, some moderation of the basic goals, really strategically a better match for, you know, what would best serve, or is it actually, you know, a little bit of a wolf in sheep's clothing? You know, I guess that remains to be seen. You know, it's such a breakthrough to contemplate making some of these major shifts. You know, and so the incremental idea is, oh, well, let's not do it all at once. That might be too much. But on the other hand, it might be easier and more effective to kind of do it all at once together. And that's almost like making the case for doing that is really a major distinction, at least in my mind.
Yeah, well, you know, I won't say the left, but liberals and Democrats should really take a page out of the book on the right, which is that they, when they get into power, they do not care about they don't care about polls, public opinion. They just do what they want. They force through their often quite radical measures, and radical in a bad way. You know, the radicalism isn't good or bad in itself. You know, which direction you radical in. But yeah, they just do whatever they want, and then it makes it very hard once they've sort of done these maybe deep-seated changes. It's very hard to undo them. Whereas, you know, I mean, we saw with Obama. I mean, almost all of Obama's main accomplishments have been torn up by Trump over the past 4 years because they were ultimately they were too incremental. You know, and also the way that they were done, just, they were vulnerable to that, and that's something that the Democrats don't really do. So yeah, I agree. It's I think it's good that these two are two of the front runners at the moment, and that they're dominating the conversation.
Yeah, well, It'll be interesting to see that evolving, and I hope it evolves the right way. Well, we're coming to the end of our show time, and thank you so much. We've been speaking today with Branko Marcik of Jacobin, and in these times, please follow his work in these outlets. Listeners, and if you've enjoyed the program, share it on social media so others can enjoy, and you can find it, if you're not listening to this live, in the Connect the Dots archive, which is at connectthedots.podbean.com. And you'll also find a host of other interesting programs and conversations with journalists, advocates, organizers, filmmakers, a whole bunch of folks covering these interesting times. Thank you so much, Branko, for being with us today. Really, really appreciated the conversation and your insights very, very much, as well as your writing, which is really terrific.
Thanks for having me. It was great.
Thank you, listeners, for being with us on Connect the Dots. We'll be back next Wednesday at 10 a.m. Eastern Time on the Progressive Radio Network. I'm Allison Rose Levy.
And there was day and there was night. And there was dark and there was light. There was pink and there was the sky.